Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get three-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Positively Trek. My name is Barry, and with me, as always, is Dan the Man Gunther. How you doing, Dan?
Hey, Barry. Doing really, really well. Dreaming of faster-than-light propulsion today.
Right? It's actually amazing how often I think about just getting on with it and traveling to, you know, another planet really fast, or you know, what exactly it would mean to get transported somewhere. Would you feel like pins and needles? It just gets my brain going. And so I think we can drop it pretty fast here and say that the grab bag episode we have for you today has a lot to do with the different types of Star Trek ships and modes of transportation in Star Trek. I have just come back from a trip to my mom's house. She lives kind of more in central-ish Alberta, whereas I'm up in the north more. And there really came a point where I didn't want to be on the road anymore, and was like, man, if I could just transport to her house and just do it that way, I mean, I guess it would mean that you know, you couldn't miss dates quite as easily or anything like that, or whatnot. I mean, certain conveniences, but boy, I sure could have gotten into that convenience on that little bit there. So
I always wonder about things like that. Like, what would the world be like if you could transport places? And my brain goes to all kinds of different things, like those fun little things you encounter on the way to somewhere. Would that be lost? If we were beaming around the world all the time, and like, I don't know, it's like, oh, I want to go to Paris, and I disappear in Grand Prairie and appear in Paris. I mean, part of me would definitely not miss a 3-hour layover at some, you know, airport somewhere, but I don't know.
Pearson.
Yeah.
Sorry, who said that? Yeah, you know, and it reminds me actually of when the railroad was becoming a thing around the world, and people were starting to travel on faster and faster moving trains. It was postulated that there would be a certain speed that people would reach, and I don't remember this. I was spending so much more time researching Star Trek stuff, and this literally just came to mind, so I don't have the exact numbers, but there was actually a postulated speed that if it went any higher, it would suck all the air out, and everyone inside of the train car would suffocate because the train was moving too fast. And I think they had it at like 120 miles an hour or something like that, which we scoff at these days. But I have also, while driving a car, thought, like, imagine just like bringing a person from the 1700s, early 1700s, putting them in a car and driving at highway speed, and how just panicked they would probably be at just immediately moving that fast. It would be panic inducing, disorienting, much like the way my dog is. Every time we put her in her kennel in the car, there's usually about a hour to hour and a half window where she will puke, because she just spends all of her time trying to resist. Like, she'll kind of try to resist against the car's motion, because I think she feels like if she can resist it, she can stop it. But you can't stop that much momentum there. They're sweet, sweet little dog. But and then, yeah, she ends up puking, which is always a delight.
Oh, poor little. Yeah, the doggy physicists haven't quite cracked that one yet, but
no. I guess it kind of reminds me of Zefram Cochrane when he's going at warp speed and he's like flipping out, whereas Riker and Geordi are just chuckling behind him, because you know, they know what's happening. I imagine it'd be something like that.
Yeah, I guess with every like advancement or change or moving into something more convenient, there's always going to be that you're leaving something behind, right? Like the freeway system. Now suddenly Route 66 and all of those communities, they're just all getting bypassed and stuff in the States. And like every incremental advancement, how, if you want to put it that way, or every incremental change that we move along, you're going to leave something behind. You're going to lose something for everything that you gain. So,
You're absolutely right.
You've got me philosophical today.
Yeah, well, I like to do that. My wife asked me if I have an off button just the other day on that. Because, yeah, like I've thought about that a lot, too. As some of you may know, I've for the last over a decade, I've had a very long commute to my place of work, 45 minutes about each way. And I mean, it's meant that I've been able to listen to a lot of podcasts and listen to a lot of audiobooks and all that sort of stuff, which is great, and get a lot of, you know, thinking done while I'm paying attention to the spectrum of responsibility in front of me. But I do have to say that, like, when you are traveling at those speeds and stuff like that, you know, you have to be on. And it harkens me back to when I lived in UK and I rode trains. I rode trains everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it really puts a different spin on travel. I actually looked forward more to traveling by train personally. In fact, I had a thing, it was around 2009, 2010, and I had a copy of Star Trek 2009 on my laptop. Mm. And riding the train from London to Durham, I would watch Star Trek 2009 going there and coming back at least once each time. Oh, and, wow. You know, I'd have my little sausage pasty and I would have, you know, some kind of like old Jamaican ginger beer or something, or some crisps with me and a book to read. And it was lovely. I really love traveling. It's like kind of like getting food cooked for you. I really like it when someone else is doing the driving. So if we could, as a society, move to trains, I would personally be 100% for it. We would leave behind, I suppose, is independent travel. But I see the efficiency of public transit and train systems, especially high-speed rail. Man, I'd love to see some of that. So I guess on that, we should get to the actual topic here and start just, maybe I can give the audience an idea of what we're going to be talking about. The first thing is I have to say I have had a love affair with the design of the Star Trek ships throughout my life. Obviously, I have a very warm place in my heart for other designs, and we will get into that topic at the end. But I want to maybe take a bit of a tour through some of the designs of the Star Trek ships. And I suppose maybe podcast isn't the best medium about talking about something very visual, but I suppose we are going out on a limb and expecting most of the listeners to have those visuals in their heads already and some favorites. Otherwise, we should have done this on Kurtrats, I suppose.
Yeah, podcast, the audio medium sometimes doesn't lend itself to this, but you make a good point. You know, us Star Trek fans, we're familiar with these ships. We've seen them over the years. I think we can do a pretty good job of visualizing these for sure. But and I'm sure everybody out there has their favorites, that every Star Trek fan has their favorite starship, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the second one is we want to talk a bit about getting around. So the different types of getting around, if it's within the ship, if it's outside of the ship, the very different ways that ships will propel themselves or, I guess, semi-teleport, all of that stuff. And then finally, we're going to just compare Star Trek ships to other franchises. And I'm guessing you can probably guess some of the gimmies, I suppose, but there will be hopefully some surprises in there as well. So starting off, I want to maybe talk a bit about Walter Matt Jeffries, that is, and Phi, funny equal sign, I don't know, I've only read these things, I haven't actually seen it, 1.618, also known as the golden ratio. So basically, Matt Jeffries was an aircraft designer. He was extremely meticulous from the research that I've been looking into. He was very much looking for something that wasn't just a rocket ship that emitted smoke or any of those sorts of things. And it had to have a certain visual aesthetic appeal. And I don't know, I think sometimes the simplicity of the 1960s design can be like, oh, it's just a couple of tubes put together and all this sort of stuff. But if you really think about the lasting legacy of the Jeffries design, it is the common thread that exists between all of the, well, at least Federation starships, and to some degree, I would say Klingon as well, because his design of the Klingon ships was also based on, I guess, sort of Klingon-Romulan ships was based on that golden ratio as well. And I think the best way I can explain it is I used to play one of the Star Trek app games, the one with like the cards. I forget which one it is. Star Trek Timelines, I think it was called. And usually, you know, like there wasn't like blinding space combat or anything. And typically your ship was just parked somewhere between like the ship. And then there's like a really cool background depending on wherever you were. And I always found myself, especially with the TNG era Enterprise, I'd just be using my thumb to like move the camera around. And just, I remember thinking to myself, like, this thing's beautiful. No matter which angle I give it, I'm looking at it from the rear, I'm looking at it from underneath, I'm looking at it, you know, 45 degree angle down and slightly to the left. You know, any certain way you look at that ship, it's gorgeous. And maybe, again, I have a serious bias in that respect, but it does lend itself to a certain type of symmetry that your eye just can't really look away from. It's something that really does have a gorgeousness to it. I think about the way it's even portrayed on Star Trek the Animated Series. I really feel like they got their rulers out, right? Because you can't get that design wrong, right? Mm-hmm. You can always tell when someone hasn't gotten the Enterprise design right. It just doesn't look right. And I guess that's the thing, is your eyes are, I guess to quote Red Letter Media, there was a saying, they said, you didn't notice, but your brain did. And I think that's the best part about this whole design that he put together. So yeah, those are some of my kind of opening salvos on the actual design of the Starship Enterprise originally. And just starting off with how just freaking gorgeous that thing is, and how it is very hard to find a bad angle on that thing. I wish you could say the same thing about myself. I'm just not that symmetrical.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Just an absolutely iconic design that, you know, what's that saying? The everything that comes afterwards stands on the shoulders of giants, right? This design, and especially when you consider, like, every Star Trek design that has come afterwards, as far as Starfleet ships go, they're based on this, right? Like, this is the starting point. Even some of the more wild designs, like the Defiant and all that sort of stuff, we'll get to. But this was the prototype, the original Star Trek design. And when Matt Jeffries designed it, he started with nothing. The fact that this design has endured so well for nearly 60 years now is an incredible testament to, like you say, the golden ratio, how it looks perfect from just about every angle, and the feel of it, this, at the time, this city in space. You know, it wasn't a flying saucer, it wasn't like Lost in Space, it wasn't a weird rocket thing from
Flash Gordon,
thank you. I was going to say Captain Proton, I'm like, nope, that's the Flash Gordon pastiche. But same difference, right? But yeah, it's not that. It really, like, I'm biased, of course. I love Star Trek. It's my first love when it comes to media and stuff. But I think you can also take the debut of the Enterprise on the screen as this inflection point from where science fiction before it and science fiction after it, at least as far as filmed science fiction goes, it really was this sea change for the entire thing, where now suddenly this is something that's taken a little bit more seriously. This looks real and feels real. And a lot of that is down to the design of the Enterprise.
Well, and to build on that, it very much has set the tone for what future, quote unquote, looks like. I mean, mm-hmm. we can talk about how Star Trek, you know, kind of foresaw us with tablets in our hands that had, you know, little beep boopy screens on it and stuff, right? The PADD, and how that's basically become the iPad, or, you know, tablets and all that sort of stuff. Self-opening doors, tricorders, saying the name of the computer and then it doing what you say with, I can't say their names, either of the two licensed people who you talk to get your information, because I have one of them right next to me and the other one's in earshot. And if I say either of their names, they will respond.
They're always listening, Barry.
Yeah. No, and I have mine shut off. It's actually the other phone that's sitting down here that will answer me. Yeah, no, but you're right. Even my phone's listening to me, even though I have it shut off, of course. But the idea that, you know, we have a lot of very realistic, futuristic aspects. But I think when you think about, I would say that when you think about a futuristic ship, it's often very much the Star Trek ship that comes to mind, or it's a joke or a play on it in so many different cases. Now, that's not to say that other franchises would follow suit necessarily. But I do have to say that Matt Jeffries didn't just design a ship. He created an entire genre. It's very much like in the 60s, we saw a lot of different genres of music emerge, right? You see the emergence of punk. You see the emergence of like Motown music. You know, even the tiniest elements of rap start to show themselves by the late 1960s. I would say that in terms of a pop cultural phenomenon, the move from, yeah, just these simple looking rocket ships that had a bit of smoke trailing behind them to Star Trek, it is very much something that completely shifts everything on its head and sets us on a trajectory to sort of look at the future and the future of space travel from this idea of Star Trek being the thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would say, even, you know, love it or hate it, the opening credits of Enterprise kind of cement what we were all already thinking, right? It shows all the different Enterprises, and it wedges in Zefram Cochrane's ship as well. But then it moves on to the Enterprise itself, which is, again, a play on the Matt Jeffries design. Those two nacelles that stick out symmetrically on either side to create the warp field, which also makes me really happy when you think about the Albuquerque, I think that's how you say it, warp field system, where, again, it's sort of like the hull that's surrounded by kind of like a propulsion unit that sort of makes gravity slip forward and sort of be wider in the back. And so it's actually not you that's moving, it's space that's moving around you. And that's why you kind of slip through it like a piece of rice wood between your fingers or something, like a wet piece of rice wood through your fingers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I could go on forever about all of the aspects of what I love about the ship, but what would you say is, you know, your favorite starship design from the Federation? Let's start there.
Well, for me, I have to always come back to the refit Enterprise, or the Enterprise A, that upgraded Constitution class that we were introduced to in the motion picture and saw through the original Star Trek films. There's just something about it where, like, it takes that Jeffries design, which I do love. Like, it's very close. Like, that's a very close second. I just feel like that refit design just kind of punted it to this next level and made it really sexy and just a really cool design. I just the other day rewatched the, not when Kirk is flying around the Enterprise and admiring it, but when it's leaving dry dock and all those floodlights come on one at a time. And, you know, the pennant on the side lights up and the deflector dish starts glowing orange, and the ship just very slowly slips its moorings and starts heading out into space. That, oh, it's just, it's so awe-inspiring. It's so gorgeous. No Star Trek, I think, before or since has felt as real as that moment, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like I'm in the spacesuit of that little guy who's like waving them goodbye, and this yeah. massive ship is just sliding past me. The variation of colors and that pearlescent paint on the hull to kind of give the illusion of hull plating, and all the little extra greeblies they've added, and the little, just all those things that you feel like if they had a little bit more money in the 60s, they might have tweaked that a bit, or if they could get the fidelity of the camera to pick that stuff up, they would have, you know, dolled the ship up a little bit with them. I feel like that is just the best treatment an Enterprise has gotten, and it is gorgeous.
And yeah, I would have to agree with you. The refit is my favorite design of the Starship Enterprise, kind of them all. And I would say very similarly the same thing. And I think it has to come down to the fact that, like, you have to see the motion picture on the big screen mm-hmm. to truly, truly appreciate that. Or if you have a big enough screen, I actually have friends who have a big enough a big enough television screen that I think I might try to ply them with cake or something to be like, you want to watch a movie that might be boring to you, but won't be to me? I'll bring ice cream cake. 'Cause yeah, you're right. You have to see that. You have to see that whole bit of, for lack of a better term, starship porn in a very large, or at least a high fidelity ratio, to get all those little details. And little details are definitely, you know, things that I think that, you know, Andrew Probert really, really built on, right? Those phase two designs by Matt Jeffries. He stayed true to the original design while still revolutionizing it, right? If you actually look at the ratios, the saucers don't even match up, mm-hmm. right? It's not a refit. It's a rebuild.
Yeah,
complete.
Absolutely.
Right? Nothing really matches, but it still falls, I think, within that golden ratio, though they add technically some kind of more finny designs. I always felt that the TMP / motion picture nacelles were kind of like Cadillac,
you know, like, yeah, the grill on the front. And, yeah.
They're very like 1950s sort of streamline train kind of style to them that for me, again, just really does it. They're chonky and again, there's still a bit of understatement to it as well. I think to some degree, Star Wars must have played a bit of a part in kind of creating that more textured design that I think we know and love about that refit. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I always think back to the 1977 when the blockade runner is right over Tatooine getting shot at, right at that very first shot. And then you get this massive Star Destroyer, right? With all those intricate little bits and points and pieces to it. And there's laser fire, whatever they call it, blaster fire happening back and forth and stuff like that. Those flashes, I think there's definitely something to be said about how, you know, Star Trek did a lot of influencing, but then also reacted to influence as well. And I think it mm-hmm. built on those things extremely well. So we're in agreement. I don't know if everyone would agree with us that the refit Enterprise is, but if you were a person of taste, of course you agree with us, right?
I will never judge a person on which Star Trek ship is their favorite. As long as they have one.
Right. Yeah. So what's your second? What would be like, where do you go with your second design then? What else kind of really speaks to you, right? If we both agree on this, it's kind of like math. It kind of cancels itself out. Where do you go after the refit?
That's a tough one. There's a lot of really great designs. One that I already mentioned, actually, which is a bit of a weird choice. I love the Defiant from Deep Space Nine. I think it's very much outside the norm when it comes to Starfleet ships. But from first seeing it on Deep Space Nine when I was a kid, showing up on the screen, and I was kind of going like, that's a Federation ship. And then a few episodes later, just being in love with that ship, that tough little ship. I'm not a very martial person. I'm not a very, you know, war is great, rah, rah, rah person. But there's just something about that compact design. It originally was supposed to be like a beefed up runabout was what they were going to do. And they're like, no, actually, yeah, we need to, let's make it a starship. But still keeping it in that, you know, tough, compact design. The interior sets, you kind of feel a little more claustrophobic, like a submarine. It's just something about it. I would love to explore a Defiant class ship.
Absolutely. And I think they have, the Defiant gets away with everything just because of its personality, right? It the ship looks like a little pancake moving through space, kind of, to me. I always thought that. And I also developed a love for the ship over time. Because, yeah, when I first saw it, I was like, you're kidding me, right? Like, you have some of the best space, like, starship designers in our genre, right? John Eves at the helm here. What the hell are you doing? And, yeah, you're right. I think it's over time. It starts to kind of grow on you. And I think it has a lot to do with the crew inside of the ship that makes the ship worthwhile in a lot of ways. If you had a lesser cast, I don't think the Defiant would have flown quite as well. Mm-hmm. Pun intended, I guess. You know, the fact that Worf sleeps on it, right? The fact that it, you know, kind of semi gets saved / saves the day to some degree when it's fighting the Borg. I mean, that's what it was originally designed for. And I always thought to myself, it would actually be a pretty good shape to go up against a cube because it could get right up against it, right? And it's got the ablative armor and stuff like that. It could kind of suction itself on like a little leech. The ship that actually it reminds me most of outside of the genre, and not completely, but to some degree, is Boba Fett's ship in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. If anyone's familiar, his ship kind of lays down on its back when it lands, and then when it gets up, it kind of moves like a person with legs would, I guess is the best way to put it. it's a very strange design, mm-hmm. and it's kind of hard to look at. But the more you think about it, the more you like it. The more you see it, the more you're like, that's kind of interesting, and I like it now.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's another Star Wars ship, the B-Wing, I think also kind of follows a similar sort of odd design that ultimately is kind of cool when it's in action.
Yeah.
I guess for me, to kind of stick with John Eaves, for me, it's the Enterprise E. The Enterprise E is, again, kind of a Marshall ship. It's not exactly the same as the Enterprise D, which always kind of feels like, you know, home. It's carpeted. That audaciously gigantic saucer section is fun, right? Again, city in space is really the idea you get out of the D, whereas the E definitely comes more into that. You know, we've encountered the Borg. We've encountered a lot of, you know, meanies out there. We can't necessarily have these big Cadillacs in space anymore. We need something a little more efficient, right? I like the kind of triangular shapes that show up on the nacelles, that kind of cloudy Bessard collector that I really enjoy. Actually, one of the STLVs, there was a guy from Germany who built an Enterprise E out of like some kind of poster board. Like it was brilliant, the work he did. Maybe I'll share that on the Facebook for people just to see, because I did kind of like a, with my phone, like a little flyby of it. There's a lot to be said about, you know, it kind of doesn't have a neck to it ultimately, the E design. And so it doesn't really follow that golden ratio. And it's a very long ship as well. If you really think about it, the nacelles kind of take up a lot of that space. But what I do like about it is it does feel a lot more kind of like a warship, like it would fit inside of that kind of Defiant style, and they kind of complement each other in a lot of ways, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I also love the Aztec style of armor that it has on it as well, the plating, which again kind of gives that texture and detail. The only thing I don't really like about the E is its bridge. I find its bridge kind of looks more like a cafeteria to me. It's very spread out. I don't quite like it as much. If you go into Star Trek Online, those kind of larger bridges are kind of fine. They sort of iron out some of those weird details and stuff. I much prefer that kind of encapsulated design that, say, like, you know, the original series had. Obviously, you see that in the movies, and then you see that on the B, and you see it on the D. Whereas, you know, the E is just way too spread out to me. I just don't like it. Like, I feel like, I don't know, like I said, it kind of feels like a cafeteria. Everyone's facing one way, though.
Yeah. I do want to bring up one moment that kind of brings our two second favorite ships together. Of course, the scene in First Contact, right, where the Defiant is, Worf's about to ram it into the Borg cube, and the Enterprise E comes in and beams the Defiant survivors aboard. I will note, I love the dialogue in that scene, if I can just do an aside here.
The Defiant's losing life support. Bridge to Transporter Room 3, beam the Defiant survivors aboard. Captain, the Admiral's ship has been destroyed.
They're focused on the Defiant, and whoops, oh yeah, the Admiral. Oh, okay, well, I'll take command then. Anyway, I do want to say, I remember when First Contact came out, a lot of people were kind of going like, oh, the Defiant is supposed to be this Borg fighting ship. Why is it getting its butt kicked? Little bit of trivia. This kind of wasn't made apparent in the final version of the film, but a more extended bit of the script would have kind of explained that a bit. If you listen to the radio chatter at the beginning, the Defiant is part of that initial wave that meets the Borg ship in the Typhon sector. There's kind of a running battle from there to Earth, and the Defiant is the only surviving ship from that initial encounter. The rest of the fleet has been, you know, reinforced and replaced, and the Defiant was the only ship that was still standing from that initial force. So just wanted to kind of get out in front of the criticism of one of my favorite ships there. Got to defend Worf and his honor there. So
I didn't know that. And actually that kind of, yeah, makes Worf even more, and Worf and the guy at the helm, he was, what's his face on Parks and
from
Rec?
Parks and Recreation. Yeah.
Yeah,
Adam Scott is the actor, and famously he's mentioned this role before. It's just Defiant Helmsman is the name of the character he played. So he always likes that because he takes it not only as the name of the ship, but his demeanor. He was the defiant helmsman.
I love it. Oh, man. No, and so, you know, we kind of, again, sort of marry eras, and maybe it has a lot to do with our age, because this really does kind of pinpoint us as teenagers in the late 90s.
Now known as elder millennials.
Elder millennials. Here we are.
Great.
Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Positively Trek is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon. A special thank you to our Constitution class supporters, Jim Stoffel, Joyce Mirren, and Paul D. Kinnear. To help out with the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek, where for a small monthly donation, you can get early access to ad-free episodes, shoutouts, exclusive content, associate producer credits, and more. Thank you so much for listening, and live long and prosper.
One thing I want to talk a little bit about is the Okudas and their interior designs and how much I have to just give them some love. I always seem to bust out the Star Trek Las Vegas stories, and I'm sorry, everyone, but it's really a point of reference I have. And so I had been in Las Vegas for the first time, and I'd only been in Las Vegas for about 4 to 5 hours, and was kind of in the process of just putting myself out there when Mike and Denise Okuda were in the cafeteria. And so I was walking around a friend of mine who was playing as the Santagorn, and wound up just getting to talk with Mike and Denise Okuda for a while. And we sat down and we had lunch and we spoke, and I had actually just submitted my main thesis paper for my master's degree. And I'd been talking about youth communication online, and I kind of proposed my arguments to Mike Okuda, and he emphatically disagreed with me on pretty much everything. He said I had good arguments, but he completely disagreed. Cause I was talking about sort of like normative cruelties in youth communication online. And, he had a much more positive outlook than I did, and was very, very like adamantly disagreed, but in a respectful academic sort of way. But I did sort of ask him, what sort of things would you want to do with, you know, how things look, you know, in terms of Star Trek now? And he rightly said, like, not much. He said, like, we really tried to make it look futuristic for the time that it was. And I would argue very much that Mike and Denise Okuda sometimes wind up sort of the unsung heroes, because we're always talking about the outsides of the ships, whereas, you know, if you like the way the bridge looks, it's Mike and Denise Okuda in at least our generation of time, the elder millennial generation of time, of why those ships' designs on the inside look the way they do and why they look so good. And I think the user interfaces always looked believable to me. The way the screens were set, the way people, you know, it didn't feel as much like a submarine anymore. It actually felt a lot more like a naval ship, right? Mm-hmm. Where people would be at screens, or mission control, shall we say, to some degree as well. So just a quick little shout out to the Okudas and their design.
Yeah. And very, I think, And I mean, like you say, we come from a particular generation, a particular time. Maybe younger people today wouldn't necessarily agree with me, but I feel like those designs on the Enterprise D bridge and stuff, they feel very timeless to me.
Absolutely.
Again, others might disagree, but to that point a little bit, bringing the Okudas and Doug Drexler and folks like that back for Star Trek Picard, notably seasons 2 and 3, with the bridge of the USS Stargazer and Titan. Just gorgeous work that they did there. And how cool must it have been for them to bring these designs that they originally did with, you know, colored films behind plexiglass with lights lighting them up behind, to actual tactile interface touchpads that you could interact with on, you know, the Stargazer and the Titan. That, like, that must have been a really cool moment to see those designs kind of realized in a way that you could interact with beyond just the way they kind of did it in post on TNG and DS9 and Voyager, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, obviously L-Cars for me is something that I quite love. It's I don't know how efficient it truly is. I actually had a Samsung tablet back in the day that I put the L-Cars skin. I downloaded it and it just completely slowed down the interface and didn't really work very well. And
was,
you know,
the
whoever
old
designed
System it, 47 or something like that.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, mad shout out to the people who did it.
Here.
It's just, we don't necessarily have the same kind of software clout as others would. And as much as it sort of was a real lovely nod to our fandom, it just was too difficult for me to use. So clunky.
Well, another design I want to bring up, just because you brought up the Enterprise E, the Voyager A from the recent season 2 of Star Trek Prodigy, which really kind of melds the Intrepid class Voyager from Star Trek Voyager and the Enterprise E Sovereign class design elements. Lamar class special science vessel. Gorgeous. I love that design.
I love it too. And again, you know, it's amazing what you can do when it's just a 3D model CGI style, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, even thinking about the different looks of the Enterprise E when it goes from being a conventional model to a 3D CGI model, it's something that, you know, you can just get away with so much. And yeah, no, it is a lovely marriage of design. And I feel like it has, again, a semi-familiarity to it. Was it simply just the Voyager/E meld there, or was there something more to that?
There was some more to that. It wasn't just like Sovereign class nacelles slapped on the Voyager. It definitely had its own feel and look to it. It had the kind of the primary and secondary hull have kind of that basic Voyager shape, but
right,
with different textures and different kind of looks to the bridge and all the
proportions
that sort of
were different.
Yeah, and the Sovereign style nacelles like had the design elements of it, but they were kind of flattened a bit and it really fit together well. I think it's.
Do
a
we
really
know
nice
who
style.
Designed that?
I'm not sure. I was trying to find that out, but that information is just not anywhere that I can easily find it. Anyway.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the other kind of shout out I would like to give would be actually the Enterprise G and Bill Krause for his work. I've been following him on the social medias for quite some time now and quite enjoying his different designs and how he's put everything together. And the idea that fandom has definitely kind of found its way into the design of these ships. Like, I want to kind of give that shout out to the fans, you know, who end up winning contests to be able to design ships, like Adam Illy and his starship design. And the fact that Star Trek Online has really just gone to town on so many different variants and styles of Starfleet ships. I actually used to have on my desktop a picture of all of the different variants of ships that existed on STO. Though I haven't really played a lot of STO, I have to say I've kind of watched it sort of from the sidelines, especially when it came to the ship designs. I mean, there's even different variants on the Sovereign class that I really enjoyed and how they differentiate from each other and so on. And it goes on and on and on and on in quite a large way. But Bill Krause's design on the Enterprise G, I think, really did take a lot from that kind of the original Andrew Probert sort of style, but he definitely created a bit more of a futuristic kind of feel to it, sort of almost like a manta ray sort of feel. Mm-hmm. It actually, the saucer section kind of reminds me a bit of the Cardassian ships, the front of them a little bit, which I've always appreciated quite a bit.
Well, one thing I do have to mention, if we are shouting out fan designs that have kind of made it into the mainstream, I do have to bring up the original, Sean Tourangeau, who designed the Titan for the Pocketbooks novel lines back in I guess it'd be the early 2000s. Yeah, it would have been after Nemesis. So yeah, early 2000s. And then that's now made its way into canon Star Trek as well. So yeah, and also the USS Aventine from the novels afterwards as well, which has been ported into STO as well since.
Yes.
Gorgeous, gorgeous designs.
I have that Eagle Moss ship of the Aventine.
Oh yeah,
and me too. Have to say it is truly gorgeous and almost bird-like to me. It's the way it looks kind of in the front there. Very, very sort of, again, kind of strange look. Tiny, tiny nacelles. But no, the Aventine is absolutely beautiful.
I think it was Mark Rademacher made the Aventine, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay.
Just to shout him out too.
Fair enough. Well, I think there's also a bit of a shout out to, and I've forgotten his name, but what got me back into Star Trek in 2009 was Ryan Church's designs.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we've got the 2009 JJ Trek. I guess the, you know, kind of a hearkening back to the 1950s. Bubbly is the way I'd like to consider those ships. For whatever reason, they feel kind of bubbly. Is the word I would use for them. Kind of come, you know, tighter sort of designs, big though, really big in comparison.
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna put my nerd hat on here and say the warp nacelles are too big, they're too close together, and the secondary hull is pushed too far forward. Humph. No, I'm just kidding. I
true.
There's aesthetic things that bugged me about it, but you can't deny that he helped bring back Star Trek in a big way in 2009.
Absolutely.
So
and that weird whining noise they make when they fly around. And,
yeah, that too. And then every time it flies by, you hear the just one sound from the bridge for some reason, though.
Yeah. One thing that I do like, and this is a real nerd hat moment, is when they're headed to Vulcan to assist and whatever, and they're all popping off into warp, that pop, pop, pop. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, for whatever reason, I'm just like, yes, that is it. That's the way. That is so cool.
That is really
the way
cool.
They just sort of, yeah, the way they would just kind of pop and yeah. Be gone. That always really, really got me.
And then in Into Darkness, for some reason, they added weird contrails. And I'm like, yeah. Stop that.
Well, they did that in the movies as well at certain points too, right? The little rainbows and
yeah,
all that sort of stuff.
The rainbows I didn't mind, but like they did this weird thing. Sorry, this is my nerd rant again. But like mm-hmm. It would go into warp and the camera would follow like into these contrails and you'd hear like this tinkling like that's left behind little yeah. Ice crystals or something. And I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah, anyway. It's a little frustrating. Well, any other points you want to bring up on the designs of the ships? I think we've done a pretty good job of kind of working our way through favorite designs and all of that. I mean, I guess we could get into the Enterprise B / Excelsior, I would say the hardest working extra ship in Star Trek, always showing up all the time.
Yeah.
I always loved it when it was in the big fight with the Dominion and that one's like kind of cartwheeling away as it's been damaged really badly.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, that was always kind of a badass shot of the of an Excelsior class just getting owned, sadly, but at the same time, love those ships.
Well, some quick just rattling off ones that we haven't mentioned that I think are worth a mention. Richard James and Rick Sternbach for their design of the USS Voyager. I think
yes,
a good design, solid, you know, following in that TNG kind of design ethos. And then I also want to mention Doug Drexler. We touched briefly on the NX-01, mm-hmm. but I think that deserves a little bit of an extra call out here. One of the things that I loved about his design of the NX-01 is that every little tiny thing on that CG model, that very, very complicated CG model of that ship, has a purpose or something, right? Like every little hatch was designed to, you know, if you asked him, he'd say, oh, those little things that look like landing pads on the side, those would open up and little worker bees would come out for doing maintenance. That those little things there, those are deuterium refueling ports. These, like, he really just every square centimeter of that ship had something that it did, and it was very practical. And I love that. I think that's really cool.
Doug Drexler is the Imagineer of Star Trek for me. Yes. I got one of his calendars every year for probably a decade solid.
Yeah.
So many wonderful designs. There you go. Yeah. We're looking at one right now. Yeah. No, he is, he lives, eats, breathes, and sleeps Star Trek ships in a way that even I would have to say I admire. Because he can draw them too.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing I would shout out with regards to him is the refit version of the NX-01, which would have been, had Enterprise continued, what the ship would have ended up looking like, which until recently only lived in kind of outside of canon stuff. But now with Picard season 3, that finally got realized on screen, and you could tell from his social media posts how giddy he was about that. So that's really cool.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to getting around in other ways rather than the ships themselves. And I just have 3 points that I want to bring up on this. And the first one is artificial gravity. The obvious answer to all of this is shut up, Barry. They were doing a TV show for low budgets, you know, on the Desilu lots or eventually Paramount lots. They weren't able to suspend people in the air when things went wrong. That's just too much work. This isn't Hong Kong. It's not Wirework Cinema and all that sort of stuff. Even though I do think that an opportunity was lost to work with Hong Kong Cinema and Wirework, because then you could get people floating around all the time. That said, all of that just totally said, then the other problem is anyone with long hair, you know, obviously that's going to be an issue. So I keep arguing with myself here, but I have to say that getting around the Starship's Enterprise, all of the ones, has always been interesting, because you never really fully, when they're running through the ship, it never really gives you a sense of exactly how much distance they're covering, how far they're actually going. And, you know, a couple of different kind of tangents that I could go on really quick was, you know, in Doug Drexler's design of the Enterprise, NX-01, there was the sweet spot, right, mm-hmm. where you could kind of float around in the middle. Or when you think about Through a Mirror Darkly, when to fight the Gorn, they just turn up one of the gravity platings to pull it down to the ground so they could kill it more easily versus, you know, you and I talking in Disaster about when all the power goes off in the ships. Why isn't everyone floating around? Obviously, the simple answer is it's television and it was filmed on Earth, you doyoy. But I do have to say that this basically gives me the idea that the artificial gravity plating is just actual magic. It's the true magic of Star Trek. There's never been a suitable explanation for it. And that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, the gravity, I think early on, like in Enterprise, it's supposed to be just kind of a field that's generated throughout the ship, which is why you get that sweet spot. And then in later iterations, it's supposed to be grav plating inside in each deck or something like that. Which begs the question, why is there gravity in the turbolift tubes? Because now your turbolifts have to actively fight against gravity if they want to go up. And if you're outside of a turbolift, you can fall. So, there should be no gravity in some place. Like when you're moving cargo around a cargo bay, why would you want gravity in there?
Exactly. Like when Riker is fighting the monster Reman in Nemesis.
In the
right?
bottomless like, pit below deck 29. Yeah.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of oopsie doodles there. I would say that is only matched by the interior of the Discovery when they're like moving around it and all the worker bees and the turbo lifts and stuff, and you're just like, how big is this thing?
I say.
The interior of the ship is very much always something of convenience, right? It's always going to be kind of this is convenient for us to use and to utilize, and therefore this is the actual magic of it.
Mm-hmm. There's a YouTube channel that showed like the actual size of the Enterprise D, and then the noting that in several episodes they say that the population of the ship at any given time in those two instances, once was 1,014 people, and it shows the ship and then like the concentration of those people all kind of standing together. And it's like this postage stamp sized little bit on this huge starship, and like calculating the internal volume and the number of people, it, like, you could wander for days without seeing someone, apparently.
It's such an empty, it's like an empty dying mall.
Yeah, which makes, like, I don't know, the Enterprise feel like some sort of gothic horror thing now. Like, hello?
It's Starship Mine, but, like, in like, a really terrible way.
Yeah, which is, and it's weird. We only ever saw the same five or six rooms and the same two or three corridors.
That's because they didn't have to go to any. We barely ever saw the dolphins.
Yeah.
I actually have that cutaway Enterprise poster from way back in the day. Some of you will immediately know or be able to look at it while you're listening to this or know where it is in your house. I have it in my office, which I have to move to my new office, which is where I'm talking to you from now.
One thing I have, and actually it's on the shelf behind me here, the Star Trek The Next Generation blueprints.
Oh, yeah.
Which is ridiculous. It's deck by deck. Like, at some point, they run out of things. They're like, okay, well, here's another lounge. Here's another supplemental engineering room. Like, this is one deck. The Enterprise D is insanely massive. So many rooms. Those are all, like, lounges or something. I don't know.
Makes you think, like, in episodes where it blows up. Like,
oh,
the carnage.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll talk a little bit quickly about the deflector arrays, and I think that was a really good workaround as well. There's obviously going to be little tiny particles in space that you're going to run into from time to time, especially moving at impulse. I also think very much that, you know, from the rocket ship design that was original, and something that I think they were starting to realize was a thing when going out into space in the 1960s and onward, was the idea that a tiny particle moving through space, the size of, you know, a Phillips, you know, head screwdriver, could ultimately completely destroy your entire ship if it hits you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to consider. And the way they worked through that, again, I think is a very interesting thing, that this array kind of creates sort of something, you know, it's what projects the shields outwardly as well. But also, yeah, all those tiny little particles that could completely destroy your ship are now getting deflected quite easily. Mm-hmm. And that shows up again, you know, obviously other sci-fi, notably Star Wars, uses that concept as well with deflector shields and everything like that. And you actually see in later iterations of Star Wars what happens when you collide with a deflector shield. It ain't pretty. So I appreciate that. And again, just kind of like a really quick piece before we get into another question I have for you, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the transporter paradox? Do you think that that what the transporter does is it takes you apart cell by cell and reconstructs you somewhere else? Or do you think that it destroys you cell by cell and puts you through that what they call the pattern buffer, where then you are recreated somewhere else as an exact copy of what you once were, meaning the you that was born dies, and a you that is a perfect, exact, indistinguishable copy, even with, you know, perhaps like cancer cells or something inside, gets put somewhere else. Where are you? And are you one of those, yes, it just works for the story, shut up, Barry. you can also take that one too.
Well, for my own sanity in watching Star Trek and my own hope for the future, yeah, it absolutely breaks you down and sends you somehow via a matter stream, I think they call it, and recombines you on the other end exactly as you were, with no loss, yada yada yada. If that's the case, where did Thomas Riker come from? Well, to that I say, shut up. There's the transporter paradox. I don't know, like, from the lips of the man who invented it in Star Trek Enterprise, he says it doesn't make a quantum duplicate of you. It actually sends you. So I'm just going to believe him and hope he wasn't just, you know, taking the money and running.
Because who would know ultimately too, yeah. Right? I think that's the thing, is these things being little suicide boxes. I guess for me, where I really finally thought about it was years into my teen years, when I finally watched, again, we go back to the motion picture, and you have that botched transport that takes place, and that screaming Vulcan. Oh my gosh, like, that really, I still fast forward through that sometimes, to be perfectly honest with you. I still, and like, no wonder Bones can't handle transporters. Yeah. Like, jeezum crow. Like, that was probably one of the most, like, you know, we talk about more recent Star Trek being gruesome. That was incredibly gruesome. That was horrifying.
Yeah. The fact that, like, in that same movie, after that is when, you know, one of them refuses to get into the transporter beam and come on board, and they all kind of chuckle and say, oh, well, let me go have a talk to him. Like, no, he's perfectly like, are you kidding? You just saw. And if you read the background material or the novelization or whatever, you just saw your new science officer and your wife get destroyed by that transporter, Kirk. Like, what the hell's the matter with you? I'll always, what we got back didn't live long, fortunately.
I explain the transporter paradox to students and other people who are either captive audiences or willing to listen. The idea that I could type out an entire essay, right? And then I could print it. And then that would be the essay I have. And then I could delete that file and make it disappear. Well, which one's the original, right? And then I could take that essay that I wrote, and then I could scan it onto a PDF document, and then I could set fire to the paper copy, and then have the PDF copy, which one's the original.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could take that PDF copy and reprint it, and then delete the PDF copy completely, and then have a printed essay. What's changed?
Yeah.
And that's the end of, and like, that's the thing is, like, it gets us into a very ethical dilemma. And I would love to actually, like, really delve into the ethics of the transporter one day, perhaps, and get like someone who maybe knows more than you and me on that sort of thing.
I feel like that's an episode kind of in and of itself for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The transporter paradox, and like, should we be afraid of this idea, and what truly is existence in that respect too? I mean, if it is a suicide box that kills you and recreates you elsewhere, I'm never taking a transporter under no circumstances. Yeah. No.
Well, I love this, you know, person I was talking to about this, and they totally played devil's advocate and kept switching back and forth between this thing. So it was like, it's a break in consciousness. Your consciousness stops. So therefore what comes out on the other side might not necessarily be you. And you're like, yeah, that makes sense. I says, well, what about when you go to bed? Your consciousness stops when you fall asleep and starts again when you wake up. How do you know that you didn't just wake up this morning as a being with all the memories of some other person? That what if you just were born this morning and you have no idea? You don't know. And I was like, oh yeah. So it gets to some fun places, that argument.
Isn't that like the flying spaghetti monster creationism theory, that the entire universe was created 45 minutes ago and everything before that is an implanted memory?
Prove it wrong. And I know that's not how proof works, but
no. Oh man. Well, let's finish off our conversation by maybe comparing these lovely aspects of Star Trek, the ships, how we get around and all that sort of stuff, to some other franchises. And obviously I want to start with Star Wars, just because I do have to say I grew up on Star Wars as well. And I love the kind of more dirty looking ships of Star Wars, right? They're less symmetrical. They've got little doo-wackies and bit bobs kind of sticking out of them. They seem a little more like the International Space Station, right? It's kind of cobbled together a little bit. Yeah. Versus the new Chinese space station, which looks like you could like set your watch to it. It's so kind of perfect in the way it was designed. But there is something about that kind of scruffy, dirty kind of junkyard spaceship that is also somewhat endearing. And so I might ask, just to start again, do you have a favorite Star Wars ship?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, you know, some of the fighters are always fun. I found myself drawing the TIE fighter a lot in my notebooks for some reason when I was younger. I liked the simple shape of it. But, you know, the X-Wing, I love the asymmetry of the Millennium Falcon with the cockpit off to the side. That just always kind of struck me as fun. You know, the kind of cobbled together, rough and tumble rebellion stuff versus not clean, but the very symmetrical, put together Empire stuff that kind of had this imposing feel. I like a good Star Destroyer too. There's a lot in Star yeah. Wars that I like, but yeah, probably the X-Wing. I like the deploying the S-foils and zipping around like you're a World War II Spitfire or something.
Absolutely. I think for me, it's always going to be the Snowspeeder. I've always loved the Hoth Snowspeeder. I love the fact that when they like turn left or right, the little panel comes up to like help kind of turn the ship a little bit faster. I actually have a Snowspeeder model somewhere in my collection of kitsch somewhere, and one of the panels has been knocked right off, and I remember initially being quite upset that that was the case, but I'm like, no, that's like totally Star Wars, of course there'd be a Snowspeeder with a missing panel or something, right?
I can only turn left, guys.
Yeah, sorry. Otherwise it's gonna be a really, really wide turn.
I'll get otherwise. There, it'll just take me a little longer.
Yeah, no, I think that you know, obviously moving into sort of the sci fantasy or the you know, instead of science fiction, science fantasy, you can get away with a lot more, right? The hyperdrive isn't quite the same. There's hyperspace lanes, all that sort of stuff. And then, like we said, you know, there is sort of a personality that gets drawn upon when you look at, say, an Empire versus a Republic ship, or a Rebellion ship, or whatever you want to call it. And I know they've done a lot more work on that recently. There's been so much more to the ships and everything. But there is maybe something a little more utilitarian about those ships. I mean, I'm thinking about Andor, that mm-hmm. series. Like, there is no special ship in Andor. It's, you know, it's like getting into a... Chrysler LeBaron, you know, like it's a car and it'll get you to the place you need to go. There's nothing special about it, but there is still that imposing scariness of the TIE fighter that, you know, kind of buzzes some of the characters at certain points and whatever else. But no, I appreciate the Star Wars outlook on things. There is still kind of that rocket feel with the especially, like, say, the back of the Star Destroyers with those three massive, and then there's the four kind of smaller rockets on the back of those. But no, outside of that, I do have to say that, like, Star Wars, you know, has some of those very iconic, you know, you think about that, but you don't necessarily think about those ships in the future, because of course it all took place long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, apparently. What would be a franchise you would say you enjoy the designs of?
I mean, Babylon 5 comes to mind with the design ethics of each of the major races in the series, including like some of the background races, one of whom just has the stereotypical UFO, and you're like, oh, those are the guys that visited.
There you go. Yeah.
But I love, like, if you're familiar with Babylon 5, you have the like organic looking Minbari ships and the Vorlon ships and the very, you know, imposing looking kind of rough Narn ships and the kind of pretty Centauri ships, but also very dangerous. And then the very industrial Earth ships with big rotating sections to do gravity and stuff. I really enjoy the ship designs on that.
I have again on my desktop a Hyperion class heavy cruiser. Mm-hmm. Just love them. Like, it really does just scream, I'm a battleship in space, everyone. Look at me.
Yeah.
Right. Even like the fact that like it kind of has like trusses on it and stuff like that. Just absolutely very cool designs. And you know, a lot of people maybe sometimes get taken away from Babylon 5 because, you know, it's Commodore 64 graphics, and those aren't necessarily as slick or as cool as the graphics of today. And I mean, there have been a lot of people who've wanted to see, you know, new renders and whatnot, but honestly, I like to go back to it. I like to see those old styles. And honestly, again, like we said about, or like I said earlier about the way, you know, the Defiant kind of grew on all of us, it has a lot to do with the cast. It has a lot to do with the characters who are inside of, hypothetically, inside of those ships that make them good, that make them lovely.
Mm-hmm.
I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the Expanse.
Yeah.
I have on a number of occasions in the past. I like what they do with gravity, the flip and burn idea, where their only bit of space magic is the Epstein drive, right? They're still kind of rocket ships too, which I do appreciate that they've kind of gone back to. But the idea, for those of you who haven't heard, basically the idea of the Expanse is you're moving at perpetual motion. You're moving faster and faster and faster, which kind of creates an artificial gravity in that respect, because the ships aren't designed like ones you would sit down in, like a car. The ships are buildings, basically. They're designed like if a building was a spaceship and the rocket was on the bottom, all the different floors, right, your feet would be the ones pushing against the ground, which actually makes perfect sense. And then when it comes time to slow down, the ship flips, and then it slows itself down at a certain rate that, again, recreates gravity, mm-hmm. Or at least what gravity would seem to be like in different places. I do have to say that, again, you've got a ship there, the Rosinante, that goes through a number of different kind of wardrobe changes, I'd like to maybe put it, which I think is kind of cute. But it is, again, a very much, I feel the Defiant in it. Mm-hmm. I feel it is very much sort of a sibling or a cousin or a well-wishing relative of the Defiant, right? It's ugly as hell. But boy, do you just love it by the end. It's a character in and of itself in a lot of ways. And it very much, the characters themselves, just they identify with that ship.
Legitimate salvage. Absolutely.
Legitimate.
I want to shout out one that maybe gets overlooked every once in a while as far as the ship technology goes.
Yeah.
And that's Stargate. If you watch those series, so Stargate SG-1 and Stargate Atlantis, notably, and also Stargate Universe as well, but the ships that kind of come out of the later years of that, as Earth kind of starts to get its own ships and become part of the interstellar universe that way, the one thing that I love about those ships is the technology in them. Everything in it you can trace back to some earlier episode where they were just going through the Stargate, exploring worlds, gathering technology to fight the Goa'uld. All of the technology on the Earth ships, so the United States ships, the Prometheus, the Daedalus, the Odyssey, and the Russian ship, the Korolev, and the Chinese ship, the Sun Tzu, they all of that technology is from the missions of the SG teams in those early days, building Earth's technology. And it evolves over the course of a series in a way that not a lot of shows do. And I love that kind of, we're building an interstellar civilization from the ground up. And how do we do that? What would that look like? And these ships are kind of aircraft carriers in space, basically, as they get up. And again, you know, very rooted in military. It's all controlled by the U.S. Air Force and stuff. So there's some of that which I kind of turn my nose up at a little bit, but it's still a heck of a fun show, and I love seeing those ships in action.
I can appreciate that, and I just did a little image search on them, and I kind of get a bit of a Starship Troopers vibe from them. On first glance. I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up Red Dwarf, a wackily gigantic ship. It's an enormous mining vessel, kind of very much along the lines of the Nostromo. But I mean, I think to myself in a lot of ways, and maybe this is kind of goes against Battlestar Galactica and Star Wars for having their little fighter ships going around. Honestly, space is big. And it would be somewhat impractical to have little fighters zipping around. It would make a lot more sense to have massive ships with massive arrays going at each other, shooting at each other at great distances. I've often thought about that myself as well in terms of space combat itself. Much like real naval combat right now, you typically don't see your enemy with your eyeballs. You see them with your sensors and your arrays and everything else, and you're actually like calculating your firing on like the curvature of the Earth and stuff like that. So I would assume the same thing would happen with, like, you know, gravimetric parallax and you know, different gravity wells and, you know, trajectory, and like having to make calculations for the speed of light and everything else like that in terms of battle. But I do appreciate the idea that Red Dwarf was just stupidly huge in a lot of ways. And then also, you know, Firefly, not everybody likes the show, but I do have to say that, like, the ship itself, again, kind of grew on me a little bit. I liked it. Yeah. It was, again, very ugly, but at the same time, it was a nice ship to have. But the last little piece I want to talk a bit about is a ship that I don't think gets a lot of love out there, and it really, really should. And that's the Planet Express ship on Futurama. what would you have to say about the Futurama Planet Express ship and its design?
Oh, lots to say about it. From the very beginning, designed as just another character in the show, right? Like, if you look at its profile, it's got the Simpsons Futurama overbite. It's got a face, yep, just like another character, right? That's not an accident. That's absolutely intentional. And just the background stuff, like the fact that it's powered by dark matter that gets shoveled into a furnace. And apparently it's faster than light drive works not by moving the ship, but by moving the universe around the ship, which Professor Farnsworth has been told by other people that's preposterous and makes no sense. But yet it works. So
it reminds me of the 2009 Star Trek movie part when Scotty is shown his own schematics for ship to ship transport at warp, and he by Spock from the future, and he's like, "Oh, I never thought of that about calculating as space as the thing that's moving," and his whole shooting a bullet with another bullet while blindfolded riding a horse thing was quite amusing. But the Futurama ship as well, you know, talking about having its own personality, I mean, doesn't it date Bender at a certain point as well?
Yeah, and I think it's voiced by Sigourney Weaver in that one, if I'm remembering correctly.
Ah, yes. Excellent. Perfect. Yeah. Well, I think we've really gone through more than I would have even expected in terms of all the pieces that we love about the Star Trek ships and how they're put together and who put them together. And speaking of which, I will try to remember to throw that image or the video of the Enterprise E that I saw at Star Trek Las Vegas one year for everyone to just enjoy, because it is, again, a little bit of gratuitous starship porn, as we would perhaps uncouthly call it.
A little crass, but it's
a little crass.
The sentiment is appreciated for sure.
Yes. And well, you can find us on the Positively Trek Facebook discussion page, and you can also keep tuning in. We've got quite a back catalog here that I'm still quite honored to be a part of some of that back catalog as well. I don't know how many episodes I've been on, actually.
That's a good question.
Of the 270 some odd episodes,
I think. Yeah.
yeah it'd be interesting to see what number I personally am at, but it's always fun finding new things to talk about with Star Trek, and if there's ever anything you guys are interested in us talking about too, we'd be more than happy to take some requests as well. I think would be kind of neat, because as much as I like coming up with stuff, and like, I love to hear what Dan has to bring up from time to time, we typically will chat throughout the week on what exactly we're going to do. And that usually gets me on my little rabbit holes of research and everything, kind of scratches my research itch that I have. It's always interesting to know what other people are thinking about as well. If you're obsessing about something like I obsess about Star Trek, drop us a line on the Facebook discussion page.
Yeah, and let us know what your favorite Star Trek ship is as well. I'm curious to see if the people out there are refit people like us, or if there's another ship that you think is your favorite. So,
well, I think with that, keep dreaming about ships all the different styles and designs out there. And while you're at it, stay positive.
Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.
When you need to work quickly and confidently, you need Grammarly. It's a trusted AI writing partner that helps you get work done faster with better writing. And it works where you work, across 500,000 apps and websites. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get three-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.